Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Amy Harrison, a clinical psychologist, associate professor at UCL, and a clinical lead at Oldham Health, where she heads the child and adolescent pathway for eating disorder treatment. With over 13 years of experience, Amy has worked across inpatient, day, and outpatient settings using evidence-based approaches like CBT, Mantra, and family-based treatment. Amy has published over 70 research papers on eating disorders and brings a compassionate research approach to her work. Blending cognitive behavioural, systemic and positive psychology models, Amy is deeply committed to creating a warm, collaborative space where recovery feels not just possible, but truly within reach. Today we talk all about the model FBT, family-based treatment, and how this can be used for children and young adolescents who are struggling with an eating disorder. Amy, it is so lovely to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm excited.
Amazing, amazing. And for the listeners, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, of course. I'm Dr. Amy Harrison. I'm a clinical psychologist and an associate professor in psychology. And I've spent all of my career working with people with eating disorders, supporting their loved ones, and researching eating disorders in my academic post. And I'm really delighted to be here today.
Amazing. That sounds awesome. How did you get into working in eating disorders?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I always wanted to, well, I suppose from when I was younger, I heard of the idea of being a psychologist. And I was at university and I'd been working for BEAT. They weren't called BEAT at the time, but the charity that BEAT are, as a sort of peer support worker, because my own experiences of eating disorders and friends and loved ones. And a friend of mine said to me, you have to pick your niche. You have to kind of pick, the area of psychology that you want to kind of focus on. And I knew I wanted to be a clinical psychologist and work with people living with mental health difficulties. And it didn't take me very long to think, well, it's definitely going to be eating disorders. And I think eating disorders are just, they're such intriguing, puzzling illnesses. They have social components to them. They have, of course, the psychological components to them. And perhaps slightly unusually in mental health, they also have the strong biological components in terms of the causes, but also how they affect you on an ongoing basis. And so that really drew me to wanting to work in the area. And I was very lucky to have opportunities to do that. And I wouldn't want to stray. This is my niche. This is my tribe.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And I think, as you say, I think working and researching in eating disorders is so interesting because of the complexity of it and all the different factors that come into play. So I can imagine that makes for a very interesting career.
Yes. Well, it really sits with my sense of injustice, and I have a strong drive to stamp out injustice. And it just never seems fair to me that, you know, we can actually have essentially cancers that can be cured, but we still have people dying from eating disorders and, you know, being maimed by eating disorders and scarred by them. So that doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's very timely that you say that, because I know that currently going through the news, at the moment is the assisted dying bill and the concept of terminal eating disorders and untreatable eating disorders. It's a very tricky thing with the terminology that doesn't quite sit well with me. But today we were going to talk about FBT for eating disorders. So I wondered if you wanted to start by explaining what FBT is.
Yes, FBT is family-based treatment. It has had other names, the Maudsley approach, the Maudsley model, or some people might have heard of things like FBT-AM, so kind of a family-based treatment very much focused on a particular eating disorder. It's an outpatient treatment for children and young people, children and adolescents living with eating disorders that involves the whole family, involves the supporters around you coming together with you to think about ways out of the illness. And it has different stages to its treatment. It usually takes place sort of over weekly sessions, over a number of weeks, sort of up to maybe 20 weeks or so. And you would be engaging in this treatment when an eating disorder has been detected and you've been assessed. And it's a good way of treating people in the community. So, you know, it doesn't mean you have to go into hospital and it's very disruptive to your life. You would go into a clinic and be seen each week. It's a psychological treatment that draws on systemic models. So that means we're thinking about the system around the person. And I suppose one of its key ideas is that there's the symptoms not necessarily located in the individual themselves with the eating disorder, but it's somewhere in the system. So there's something about the interactions and dynamics and communication, perhaps, that something's got a bit stuck, and that's made the eating disorder more necessary. And so the work is to try and unravel that a little bit and find different ways of being together as a family, and really involving your parents as a resource in fighting off the illness. So it's not about saying anyone's to blame or parents cause eating disorders, because of course we did have that in the history of eating disorders. There have been messages put out there that families or parents are to blame, but that wouldn't be what we'd be saying in FBT. It's not true anyway. It actually positions your caregivers as, I suppose, the central actors or agents in helping you in your recovery. And it asks your parents to take responsibility for feeding you, for restoring your nutrition, helping to intervene and interrupt in eating disorder behaviours. So they're very much part of the treatment. And it asks the family to consider the severity of the situation. So it talks about how being starved and malnourished are very significant, very urgent medical issues that need to be faced head on and are an emergency, a crisis, that mean the family need to unite and help to get this eating disorder out.
Yeah, I really liked what you said about the fact that it asks the family to come alongside and to use the family as a resource. You know, I think there's a lot of misconceptions possibly still nowadays that the family can be to blame for eating disorder. So I think that's a really nice thing to highlight. And I was just wondering, in terms of who this treatment is for, is it for a particular diagnosis? Do you have to be a particular age? Is there anything specific like that people should know about the treatment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I suppose in terms of its history, it was initially developed to try and help young people, particularly facing the eating disorder of anorexia nervosa. But it has been used to help people with other eating disorders like bulimia nervosa. There's a bit less work around binge eating disorder or other forms of eating disorder. But yeah, I think as long as we can identify what the eating disorder behaviours are, we can apply the systemic thinking and the model to try and to help mobilise change. In the randomised control trials, the sorts of participants that were involved in those studies when they were testing out to see whether this therapy was any good, and, you know, how long its effects might last. A lot of the families that were involved there were where both parents came together and there were perhaps not so many other illnesses going alongside the eating disorder. But of course, we know in real life, families come in all shapes and sizes. And it's quite uncommon to have an eating disorder without other things as well, like anxiety or mood difficulties, or maybe forms of neurodivergence. So it should be for everybody, and it is for everybody. But I think it's an important caveat that, like many research trials, and there may be people missing from those studies, and we may not know exactly what they might need.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I was saying this on another podcast the other day that I actually haven't met anybody that has an eating disorder that doesn't have another condition in some form that, you know, then needs to be taken on board and, you know, considered in treatment. A question I had would be, so I'll use my situation as an example. So I'm 28. I don't live with my parents, my partner. Would I still be able to have FBT, or is it more for people that are, you know, maybe still living at home, living with their parents? How would that look?
Yeah, I think we might class you as a bit too elderly for FBT potentially. Yeah, I mean, I think it is more for sort of adolescents, for teenagers. So you can certainly use it with sort of younger adults and use some of the ideas from it, but it's targeting children and adolescents. And I think that's a very wise point to raise, that you know, if you're an older adolescent, you may have a lot more independence, you're likely to have a lot more independence, you might be taking a bit more ownership and responsibility for your nutritional intake. And unfortunately, when the eating disorder gets involved in your life, then that's very tough, isn't it? Because FBT would be asking your parents to take over responsibility for food and nutrition, and feeding you and instilling regular eating. And, you know, if you're 17, 16, 17, 18, that's a very tough position to be in, but it may be a necessary action that's needed to get you out of danger. So, yes, I think it is, in my experience, it's a tad easier to negotiate FBT if you're a bit younger, your parents are coming along, they're really working hard together. But the ideas behind it are important to all stages of eating disorders, aren't they? Because it's difficult to recover on your own. You need supporters around you. There could be interactions and social difficulties that you have with your loved ones that might be causing lots of stress and strain. And then, of course, we know that eating disorder symptoms or eating disorder behaviours are ways of intended ways to manage emotional distress.
Yeah. I think that was going to be something that I was going to say, is that I can imagine, you know, as an older adolescent, the difficulty there of, you know, in my own personal experience, when I had a relapse when I was, you know, an older adolescent, it was very much a stance of, I want to be independent now, I'm taking control, and one thing I can take control of is my food. So then to be told, oh, well, you know, now your parents have been given that control, I think that would be, you know, that's what definitely would be needed, but it would be challenging.
Yes, I think if you're a bit older, you'd want to do that a bit more, much more collaboratively, because, you know, you may well say, do you know what, I've relinquished control to this eating disorder, it's taken over again, and I actually need my loved ones stepping in and eating with me, you know, daily, so that I can get back on track. You know, people may ask or feel that they need to have that level of support and care, but in FBT we would be strongly, firmly, strictly implementing that and saying, right, parents have got to step in now and take over this and really enforce this regular eating. Because if you go through your adolescence with a starved, malnourished brain and body, then that can have developmental effects, your bones, and we might think about things like your height and your brain development and your social development. If you're very isolated and cut off and not able to go out with friends, because going out's always about food, isn't it? Yeah. So it may be necessary to sort of switch that trajectory and interfere with that path that the eating disorder is taking you on. As an adult, you do have a bit more, you know, you've got the possibility of making an unwise decision, which might be, you know, to do it yourself. And that might be, you know, that might prolong the eating disorder. And we would always encourage adults to, you know, involve supporters and work with support. That would be really important. But FBT has that as very, very central. You know, initially parents are essentially taking over. And then there's a process of handing back responsibility for food and eating to the young person.
And that was actually going to be my next question, was what does that process look like? Because, you know, obviously if somebody is struggling with an eating disorder and they're malnourished, part of FBT is for the parents to come in and to take back control of eating. How does somebody then build through that process to get back that independence and that responsibility? Because ultimately I'm assuming that the overall aim of the therapy is not for the parents to be in control forever.
You'd hope not, wouldn't you? Yes, absolutely. We want people to be independent and autonomous and able to care for themselves. I think that that sort of second part of FBT, where we want to gradually return the responsibility for food and eating back to the child or the adolescent, the teenager, the person living with the illness, is a really, really interesting one, because it's a time when the eating disorder can get back in and shout loudly again. And it's also a time of opportunity, because it's an important thing to take responsibility for, you know, maintaining your health and well-being and being able to care for your body. So it happens gradually in small steps. So it might look something like you've been managing, you know, eating, let's say you're at school and you have your breakfast and your sort of afternoon snack and your evening meal and an evening snack with your loved ones at home. And then your parents kind of coming into school and having a lunch with you or something like that, or, you know, a member of staff's eating lunch with you. You know, perhaps one of the first steps might be having a snack with less support and supervision. And maybe building up to then doing the lunch, and then you know your parent gives you responsibility for packing your lunch and taking it into school and having it. You can of course tell friends that you might need them to support you and care for you, if you'd like that. But over time, we want then to keep practicing that and keep learning, because sometimes it'll be easier than others to manage it on your own and finish it without prompts and make sure you have what you need to have. And with practice and with lots of perseverance and courage, you can gradually build that up so that the person then is taking more ownership for more of their meals. And of course, that has to be sort of developmentally or age appropriate, doesn't it? Because I think, you know, if you're a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old, you know, unless you're, you know, a chef in the making, you're probably not going to be doing all your meals and snacks, and then you'd probably be getting your snacks out, wouldn't you? But yeah, I don't think you'd be cooking the evening meal necessarily. So it's thinking about where you're at, you know, what age you are and where you're at in your development. So it needs a lot of practice and courage and a lot of learning, trial and error, and learning from what went well today and how could you do it differently next time? How are you going to build on that confidence and your ability to get to the end of that meal independently? And how's that, how does that link to, you know, that bigger life of what you'd like to do, being able to go out with your friends again and be, I mean, a word often people use is trust, be trusted to eat what you need to eat. So there's obviously others trust in you, but there's, you also have to trust yourself that you're giving yourself the right amount. And so that takes practice and time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In terms of, I guess, the wider concept of an eating disorder, obviously a big part of recovery is, you know, re-establishing regular eating and making sure that you're eating enough. Within family-based therapy, is there a kind of any, what's the right way to put this? Is there any space given to kind of look at the underlying emotions and things like that as to what has caused the eating disorder and then how to, you know, navigate life without that?
Yes, I think it does sound like what we've said is it's all about food. And we know that eating disorders are not all about food. They're about feelings. They're about all sorts of other things, aren't they? Yes, absolutely. So FBT is interesting to me in this context because it says it's agnostic about the causes of an eating disorder. So it's not really going to be focused on, it isn't going to be focused on why the eating disorder came about. It's more interested in the the setup of your system and how that's accidentally keeping it stuck. So it might be, for example, that there's less surveillance than you might need around meals, and you're kind of being, you know, it's got to a point where you're eating on your own in your room, and that's unfortunately keeping it, you know, keeping the eating sort of going, because you need a lot more care and input. So it would be, you know, it's quite practical. It draws on what we call strategic components of family therapy. But all of that involves how people feel, because, you know, we exist together, we're a tribal species, and so it's constantly going to be asking about, you know, what does it, you know, what are you feeling when your mum goes to the kitchen and puts that snack on a plate and brings it to the table? And what are some of the things we could do to help you with that feeling? What can, you know, so that the eating disordered behaviour of maybe avoiding food to kind of block out feelings isn't quite as necessary, so that you might have some other tools. And it's also very interested in the way that the eating disorder has infiltrated your family. So how has it changed relationships? What did the relationships look like before the eating disorder came around? How do those relationships look now? Sometimes eating disorders can bring people closer to us, and they really step in and care for us, and that can feel really nice. Sometimes they push people away, and people get further away from us, and they can split up people. They do that in teams as well. They sort of get in there, and you realize that all the colleagues have fallen out, and then you say, oh, that eating disorder, it's pitting us against each other. So that's often, you know, that is what happens in families. So those things are expected components of the illness. And so lots of the discussions will be how to communicate differently, how to react and respond differently when the eating disorder steps in and shouts really loudly, and repairing some of the ruptures, really, that the eating disorder provokes in our relationships and our families.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's such an important thing of recognizing how much an eating disorder can have an impact on those relationships. And, you know, for me in my family when I was younger, it definitely felt like it was me and the eating disorder versus my parents.
Yeah.
Being able to, you know, say, actually, we're not against each other, we all want to work together, and actually it should be us against the eating disorder trying to that out of the family system.
It can often feel like that at the start, that your parents are ganging up on you, forcing you to eat, and you know, it can be a very FBT could feel quite isolating and you know, quite a, you know, people have described it as hostile or as you know, very shocking experience. But this is an extraordinary problem that requires an extraordinary response, and you know, the intended actions are to get the young person out of danger. And yeah, that's it's a difficult aspect of the treatment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask, you know, are there any other challenges that you've seen that come up quite often, and how you overcome those? Because I think one of the big ones can be, you know, feeling like it's the child and the eating disorder pitted against the parents. I wondered if there was anything else that you've come up against in your practice.
Yeah, I think there's two key things. One of them is it's very anxiety provoking for parents to have to see their child distressed because they're being told they, you know, firm boundaries are now being put in place that they must eat what they need to eat to sustain their life. And that's a really tough thing for anyone to do, let alone, you know, your mum or dad. And we, you know, it's difficult to see our loved ones in so much distress because we're asking them or we're telling them that they must get to the end of this meal. And it's often a lot easier just to say, okay, that's all right, you've had half of it, that's enough for today. So part of that is helping parents to find ways of getting through that anxiety and letting it, because it is going to be there. and there's this, you know, witnessing the distress of their loved one and having ways of managing that and coping with it and understanding that it's a necessary consequence of the needed approach, you know, to save their loved one's life. That's hard, because I think sometimes people feel like they want to give up and they just can't bear to see their loved one in so much distress. And I think the bigger picture there is that if, you know, when we intervene early and we intervene quickly, we can usually stop this illness and stop it from coming back. But the longer it goes untreated, the more it embeds into habits and into the brain and into the family system, and the harder it is to get rid of it. And yeah, so it's always important to connect up to that bigger goal. The other difficulty is from the perspective of the young person, you know, especially in the early stages of an eating disorder, you might not feel very bad. You know, you might actually feel almost euphoric. You might feel like you're getting loads of compliments, that this eating disorder is promising you that, you know, if you do things that would influence your shape and weight, you're going to feel good about yourself and, you know, you're going to feel more acceptable, or, you know, all of its tricks and things that it promises you. And then people are coming in saying, right, hold on a minute, this is really bad. You can't do this anymore. We're now going to put all these strict rules in place, and you're really ill. And often at that stage in the illness, the young person isn't going to know that they're ill. They may not know they're ill. They may deny they're ill. They may not recognize, you know, it's very common that people don't know how poorly they are. And that can really be very hard, because it's confusing. You know, why are people so stressed out about me? Why are they telling me I've got to have all these meals and these snacks and stop vomiting or stop doing loads of exercise? I'm fine. I'm absolutely fine. And that is just the core of, you know, core thing in an eating disorder, isn't it? That the person doesn't know how poorly they are. And so then we can get into a situation where loved ones, parents may be really, really engaged and really motivated and wanting to help and do things differently. And then the young person is just wanting to do the eating disorder stuff. So those are conversations we have to have about, you know, what does that feel like for you and your family when one person's pulling one way, one person's pulling the other way? You know, have we got some common ground? Can we find some areas of common ground and some ways to move through that might make it more bearable, and particularly for the person experiencing the illness? But I would say, you know, it isn't just the young person experiencing it, it's the whole family that experience it. And so we've got to think about how it affects everybody and what each person might need and might be able to do to help. Yeah.
And that's a really good point that you just made about the fact, you know, it does impact everybody. It's not just the person that's struggling with the eating disorder.
Yeah. And that's not their fault. You know, because often people say, oh, I just want to go in the corner on my own and do my eating disorder on my own. Just back off. You know, I don't want it to affect others. And, you know, we know that's not people's intention. We know that people, you know, aren't doing this very serious and complex mental health problem, you know, as a lifestyle choice or a deliberate act. But, you know, and it does also, you know, no, what's that phrase? No man is an island. You know, it's a ripple on the water effect, isn't it? So it does affect others.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It is hard. You know, I know in my own recovery, it's been, I don't want to upset anybody. I don't want this to impact anybody, but also it's the only way I know how to cope.
And yeah.
I don't have any other strategies at the moment. So being able to work together to build those strategies, to build different coping, and to be able to be confident enough, okay, I can step away from this eating disorder now knowing that I feel safe and I feel safe.
Yeah.
I think, you know.
Yeah, and that my loved ones will interact with me in this way when they see I'm down, and maybe they'll help me meet some of my emotional needs so that I don't need the eating disorder behaviors as much. And that's a really good point, isn't it, that others can step in and help. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. And I guess just to finish us off, one thing I wanted to ask was, you know, if clinicians are listening and thinking this is something that I think could be really important for my practice, it's not something I've got training in, have you got any advice as to how they can get trained or where they can find more information?
Yeah, absolutely. So NHS teams that are very expert in this offer training. You can get the family-based treatment manual from Locke and LaGrange. And also in our service, Eltham Health, a service that I'm connected to, we're going to be doing some family-based treatment training in June. And so clinicians are very welcome to sign up and join us on that. It's going to be a three-day course where we work together, very experiential learning. So we're going to be practicing the different components and interventions of FBT and ways of talking to families and understanding them and working with them safely, because I think that's the thing, that, you know, safety trumps all, and we've got to make sure that we consider things like medical risk and what to do if we're really worried about somebody or risk escalates. So it's difficult probably to just read a manual and deliver something like this, because it's a complex treatment in the sense of it has different components to it. It draws on family therapy skills. Well, it doesn't just draw on them, it implements family therapy skills. And it can be learnt, because we do need to scale it up further, make it even more widely available, because the evidence shows it works. And compared to individual treatment, it keeps people out of trouble for longer. So it is a good tool that we've got. So yeah, people are very welcome to have a look at the information that we've got about the training that I'll be leading. If they'd like to join us, that would be wonderful.
Brilliant, amazing. And I'll put the details for the training that you've got in the show notes so that people can access that and come along.
Yeah, and we'd be thinking about perhaps psychologists, psychotherapists, perhaps nurses, eating disorder nurses, specialist nurses, be doctors, psychiatrists, people that are interested in working with families where there's eating disorders. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Amy. I feel like that was a whistle-stop tour through FBT, but I have such a clearer understanding.
I mean, it would be lovely to hear people's thoughts about FBT and their experiences of it, because I think it does vary widely. But I hope that I've conveyed that it can be done with empathy and with love and care. And it is an important tool that we have to help young people in danger get out of danger.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that just the concept of bringing the family together, I think, as we've mentioned, eating disorders can be so isolating. So having something that brings people together to work together, I think, can be really empowering for the whole family. Because parents so often are like, well, what the hell do I do? My child is doing something that I don't seem to, you know, I've got no training on how to
support. Yeah.
So I think it's such a useful treatment to bring everybody together and empower everyone to kind of have their own.
Yeah, not all those, all your loved ones and family members are important. So, that's absolutely, they can all play a role. And in fact, there are versions of FBT that we call multi-family therapy. And this is where several families might work together in a more intensive format of delivery. So perhaps might come together for a week or so and develop the FBT skills and approach, and that can be really useful, because then you get to hear from other families and see their challenges, and we'll often get a parent from one family to go and work with another one for some of the exercises, because we all offer different things. You know, I always think recovering from an eating disorder, it's like a relay race, isn't it? Sometimes you're carrying the baton and you're taking responsibility and you're doing it. Sometimes others are carrying the baton for you, and, you know, you may be lagging behind, but the idea is, how can we help you catch up? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So that you're running together. Yeah. Or maybe not running, maybe just taking a nice casual stroll.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to chat to you. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.